And first, to compel the teachers themselves to learn and approve of them, and not to employ as colleagues any of the teachers who don't please them, but to use those who agree with their approval, handing the young over to them to teach and educate. Let this be the end of my account here, spoken about both letter teachers and letters together.
As far as the plan goes, stranger, it doesn't seem to me that we've strayed outside the arguments we set out. But whether we're getting it entirely right or not is perhaps hard to say for certain.
Yes, Cleinias, that will become clearer, as is likely, when, as we've often said, we reach the end of the whole survey concerning the laws.
Rightly said.
After the letter teacher, shouldn't we now turn to the liar teacher?
Certainly.
I think we should recall our earlier discussions and assign to the liar teachers the appropriate share of both the teaching itself and of the whole education connected with such things.
What are you referring to?
We said, I believe, that the 60-year-old singers of Dionysus need to have become especially keen in perceiving rhythms and the structures of harmonies, so that someone able to select, among the imitations of melody, the well-imitated and the badly imitated, when the soul is caught up in the feelings represented, the likenesses of the good and of its opposite, could reject the latter, and bring the former forward into the open, singing and chanting them into the souls of the young, calling on each of them to follow after the acquisition of virtue by way of these imitations.
Very true.
For this purpose, then, both the lyre teacher and the pupil must make use of the notes of the lyre for the sake of clarity in the strings, matching note to note in unison. But as for the lyre's variation and elaboration, when the strings sound one melody and the poet who composed the song another, producing concord and discord by setting density against sparseness, speed against slowness, high pitch against low, and likewise fitting all sorts of rhythmic variations to the notes of the lyre, none of this should be brought to those who are to grasp the useful part of music within 3 years, and quickly. For opposites clashing with each other make learning difficult, and the young must be as capable of learning as possible, for the required lessons imposed on them are neither few nor small, as the argument will show as it proceeds in time. So on those terms, let our educator take charge of music for us. As for the tunes themselves and the words, what the chorus masters are to teach, and what sort of pieces, all of that too we went through fully earlier. The pieces we said must be consecrated, each fitted to its festival, so as to hand cities a fortunate pleasure and do them good.
True, you have gone through that as well.
Perfectly true, then. Let the man elected to preside over the muse take this over and attend to it, with kindly fortune at his side, and let us, in addition to what has been said before, deal now with dance and the whole gymnastic training of the body. Just as we supplied what was still missing on the teaching side of music, let us do the same for gymnastics. The boys and the girls must learn to dance, and to exercise, must they not?
Yes.
Then for the boys, dancing masters, and for the girls, dancing mistresses, would be none the less suitable for putting them through their work.
Let it be so.
Then let us call back the man who will have the most business on his hands, the supervisor of children, who, in caring for both music and gymnastics, will not have much leisure.
How will he be able, at his age, to oversee so much?
Easily, my friend. The law has given him, and will give him, leave to take on for this supervision whichever of the citizens he wishes, men and women. He will know whom he needs, and he will want to make no false step here, sensibly respecting and recognizing the magnitude of his office, and holding to the reasoning that when the young have been and are being well brought up, everything sails on course for us, but if not. It is not worth saying, and we do not say it, about a new city, out of regard for the great lovers of omens. On these subjects, too, we have already said a great deal, about dancing and about all gymnastic movement, for we count as gymnastics all bodily exercise bearing on war, archery and every kind of throwing, skirmishing with the light shield, and every form of fighting in heavy arms, tactical maneuvers, every sort of marching of armies and pitching of camps, and all the studies that bear on horsemanship. For all these there must be public teachers, drawing pay from the city, and their pupils must be the boys and men in the city, and the girls and women too must understand all of it. While still girls, they should have practiced every dance and combat in armor, and as women they should have a grasp of maneuvers and formations and the laying down and taking up of arms, if for nothing else, then for this. Should the entire fighting force ever be compelled to march out of the city in full strength, those left behind to guard the children and the rest of the city would at least be equal to that task. Or the opposite, and none of this can be sworn off as impossible, enemies from outside, barbarian or Greek, bursting in with some great strength and violence, and forcing the decisive fight for the city itself. It would surely be a great vice in a constitution if its women had been raised so disgracefully that they would not even do what mother birds do, fighting the strongest beasts for their chicks, willing to die and to run every risk, but instead rushed straight to the shrines, crowding every altar and temple, and poured over the human race the reputation of being by nature the most cowardly of all creatures.
No, by Zeus, stranger, quite apart from the harm, that would be an unseemly thing wherever in a city it happened.
Then shall we lay down this law, that women must not neglect the business of war to at least that degree, and that all citizens, men and women, must attend to it.
I for one agree.
Now wrestling, we have spoken of parts of it, but what is greatest, as I would put it, we have not said, nor is it easy to state in words without showing it with the body at the same time. This then we shall judge when word can follow deed and make something clear, both about the other points we have raised, and that this kind of wrestling is truly, of all movements, by far the closest kin to fighting in war, and further, that it must be practiced for war's sake, not war learned for wrestling's sake.
Well said that.
Then let this be the limit, for now, of what we say about the powers of the wrestling ground. As for the rest of the movement of the whole body, the greater part of which one would rightly call a kind of dancing, we must consider it to have two forms, one imitating finer bodies with a view to dignity, the other imitating uglier bodies with a view to the base, and again two subdivisions of the base and two of the serious. Of the serious kind, one imitates fine bodies and a courageous soul entangled in war and in violent labors, the other, a temperate soul in prosperity amid measured pleasures. This one a person would naturally call, by its nature, the peaceful dance. The warlike one, distinct from the peaceful, one would rightly name the Pyrrhic. It imitates the evasion of all blows and missiles, by swerving, by every kind of yielding, by leaping high and by crouching low, and also the movements opposite to these, carried into aggressive postures, attempting the mimicry of the shooting of bows and of javelins and of blows of every sort. In these dances, when the imitation is of good bodies and souls, the upright and the taut is right, the limbs of the body held for the most part in straight lines. Such carriage is correct, and what is contrary to it, we do not accept as correct. As for the peaceful dance, this is the way to examine it in each case. Whether a performer, grasping the nature of fine dancing correctly or not, keeps it up in his choruses in the manner befitting law-abiding men. First, then, we must cut the disputed dancing apart from the undisputed. What is the disputed kind, and how should the two be separated? All Bacchic dancing, and what goes with it, in which, naming nymphs and pans and Salinases and satyrs, so they say, people imitate drunken revelers while performing certain purifications and initiations. This whole class of dancing cannot easily be defined either as peaceful or as warlike, or as to what it does mean. The most correct way to define it seems to me, is this, setting it apart from the warlike and apart from the peaceful, to say that this class of dancing is not civic, and having left it lying there where it lies, let us now return to the warlike and the peaceful together, as belonging to us beyond dispute. Now what belongs to the unwarlike muse, people honoring the gods and the children of the gods in dances, would form one whole class, arising in the conviction of faring well. And this we may divide in two. One part, of those who have escaped out of toils and dangers into good things, holds greater pleasures. The other, where former goods are being preserved and increased, possesses pleasures gentler than those. In such states, I suppose, every human being moves the body's motions more largely when the pleasures are greater, and less when they are smaller. And the more orderly a man is, and the better trained toward courage, the smaller his motions, while the coward, and the man untrained in temperance, produces greater and more violent swings of movement. In general, no one giving voice, whether in song or in speech, is quite able to keep his body still. That is why the imitation of what is spoken, carried out through gestures, produced the whole art of dancing. In all this, one of us moves in tune, another out of tune. And indeed, many of the old names deserve to be reflected on and praised as well and naturally given. Among them is the one for the dances of people who fare well and keep measure toward their pleasures. How rightly and how musically he named them, whoever he was, who reasonably gave a name to them all together and called them Emelie, the graceful measures. And he set down two forms of the fine dances, the warlike, the Pyrrhic, and the peaceful, the Emelie, giving each the fitting and harmonious name. These the lawgiver must set out in outline, and the guardian of the laws must search for, and having tracked them down, he must combine the dancing with the rest of the music, assign to every festival of the sacrifices the portion appropriate to each, and having consecrated it all in fixed order, must thereafter change nothing that pertains to either dance or song. In the same pleasures, in the same fashion, the city and its citizens are to pass their days, remaining as alike as possible, and so live well and happily. What concerns the choruses of fine bodies and noble souls, then, what we said such performances must be like, is now complete. But the doings of ugly bodies and ugly thoughts, and of performers turned to comic mockery in laughter, mocking in speech, song, and dance, and in the caricatures all these afford, these it is necessary to observe and to recognize. For without the ridiculous, the serious cannot be learned, nor any opposite without its opposite, if a man is to be wise, but one cannot do both, if one is to share in even a small piece of virtue. That is precisely why one must learn these things, so as never, through ignorance, to do or say what is ridiculous when there is no need. Such mimicry must be assigned to slaves and hired foreigners. No serious attention is ever to be paid to it in any way. No free person, woman, or man is to be found learning it, and there must always be something new in the show of these imitations. So as for the amusements of laughter, which we all call comedy, let that stand as settled by law and by argument. As for our so-called serious poets, the tragedians suppose some of them came to us one day and put a question something like this: strangers, may we visit your city and your country, or not? And may we bring our poetry along and perform it? Or how have you decided to act about such things? What would be the right answer for us to give these inspired men? In my view, this, best of strangers, we ourselves are poets of a tragedy, the finest and best we can achieve. Our whole constitution stands as an imitation of the finest and best life, which we at least assert to be, in reality, the truest tragedy. You are poets, then, but we too are poets of the same things, your rivals in art and your competitors in the finest drama, which true law alone is fitted by nature to bring to completion. Such is our hope. So do not imagine that we will ever lightly permit you to pitch your stages in our marketplace and bring on your fine-voiced actors, outshouting us, and let you harangue our children and women and the whole crowd, saying about the very same practices not what we say, but for the most part, the exact opposite. We should be all but stark mad, we and the entire city, if it allowed you to do what you now propose, before the magistrates had judged whether your compositions are fit and proper to be spoken in public or not. So now, you children, offspring of the soft muses, first show your songs to the rulers alongside ours, and if what you say proves the same as ours or better, we will grant you a chorus. But if not, friends, we never could. Such, then, are the practices the law shall establish around all choral performance and the learning of these things, those of slaves kept separate from those of masters, if you agree.
How could we not agree, now at least on these terms?
Now then, there are three further subjects of learning for free people. Calculation and the study of numbers form one subject. Measuring length, surface, and depth forms a second. And third is the study of how the stars naturally move in relation to one another. Not everyone needs to pursue all these with precision, but only a select few, who those should be, we'll say as we go along, since that's the fitting place for it. But for the mass of people, it's shameful not to know whatever of these subjects is necessary, and in a sense, most correctly stated, while to seek precision in all of it is neither easy nor entirely possible. The necessary part of it, though, can't simply be set aside. It seems the man who first coined the saying about God had this in mind when he said that not even God is ever seen fighting against necessity, meaning, I think, those necessities that are divine. As for the human kind of necessity, the kind most people have in mind when they use that phrase, that's by far the silliest thing anyone could say.
Then which necessities in these studies are not of that human sort, but divine, stranger?
I think they're the ones such that, if a person neither practices nor learns them at all, he could never become a god among men, nor a spirit, nor a hero capable of taking earnest care of human beings. A man would fall far short of becoming divine if he can't recognize one, two, or three, or odd, and even numbers generally, if he has no idea how to count at all, if he can't even count night and day, and has no acquaintance with the revolutions of the moon, the sun, and the other stars. It's utter foolishness to think that all this isn't necessary learning for someone who's going to know virtually any of the finest subjects. But which of these particular topics, how much of each, and when they should be learned, and what should be studied together with what, and what separately from the rest, and the whole blending of them, these are the things one must first get right, and then, guided by them, go on to learn the rest. That's simply how necessity, by nature, has laid hold of things, the necessity we say no God fights against now or ever will.
What you're saying now does seem, stranger, to be correctly said, and in keeping with nature.
Yes, that's how it is, Clanias, but it's difficult to set these things down first and then legislate in that manner. Let's, if you agree, legislate about them more precisely at another time.
You seem to us, stranger, to be wary of our habitual inexperience in such matters. But you're wrong to be wary. Try to speak without holding anything back on that account.
I am indeed wary of what you just mentioned, but I'm even more afraid of those who have taken up these very subjects, but taken them up badly. Nowhere is sheer inexperience of everything a terrible or serious thing, nor the greatest evil, rather, wide experience and much learning, combined with bad upbringing, turn out to be a far greater harm than that.
True.
Well then, we should say that free people need to learn as much of each subject as the vast crowd of children in Egypt learn alongside their letters. First, in the matter of calculation, there are lessons devised expressly for children, to be learned with play and pleasure, distributing some apples or wreaths among larger or smaller numbers of people using the same total, or arranging in turn, and in sequence the buys and pairings of boxers and wrestlers, according to how these naturally fall out. And in their games, too, mixing together bowls of gold, bronze, silver, and other such metals, or sometimes handing out whole sets, as I said, fitting the uses of the necessary numbers into play, they benefit those who learn them, both for arranging and marching and campaigning with armies, and again for household management, and in general, they render a person handier in his own affairs and more wide awake. After that, in matters of measurement, of lengths, widths, and depths, they free people from an ignorance that's naturally present in absolutely everyone, and that's both ridiculous and shameful.
Ignorance of what sort, exactly?
Dear Clanias, when I myself heard about our condition in this regard, quite late in life, I was utterly astonished, and it seemed to me not the sort of thing that befits human beings at all, but rather some kind of pig-like creatures, and I felt ashamed, not only for myself, but for all the Greeks.
About what? Tell me what you mean, stranger.
I will tell you, or rather, I'll show you by questioning you. Just answer me a small question. You know what length is.
Of course.
And width.
Certainly.
And that these are two things, and depth is a third besides them.
Naturally.
Now don't you think all of these are measurable against one another?
Yes.
And length against length, and width against width, and depth likewise, these, I think, can naturally be measured against their own kind.
Very much so.
But if some of them can be measured against each other only in some cases and not in others, while you suppose all of them can, how do you think you stand with regard to this?
Clearly in poor shape.
And what about length and width measured against depth, or width and length against each other? Don't all of us Greeks think, on this matter, that they can somehow be measured against one another?
We certainly do.
But if this is in fact nowhere and in no way possible, and yet all Greeks, as I said, think it is possible, isn't it worth feeling ashamed on behalf of everyone and saying to them, best of the Greeks, isn't this one of those things we said it was shameful not to know, while knowing the merely necessary things is nothing especially fine?
Of course it is.
And besides this, there are other related matters in which we fall into further mistakes akin to those.
What sort?
The question of the natural relation between measurable and unmeasurable quantities. Anyone who examines these matters must learn to distinguish them, or else be utterly base, proposing such problems to one another constantly, spending time on a pastime far more graceful than old men's game of checkers, and competing eagerly in leisure hours worthy of the effort.
Perhaps so, at any rate, checkers, and these studies don't seem terribly far apart from one another.
Well then, Cleinias, I say the young must learn these things, for they're neither harmful nor difficult, and learned alongside play they'll benefit us and do our city no harm at all. But if anyone thinks otherwise, we should hear him out.
Of course.
Well, if it turns out that these matters stand as I've described, clearly we'll admit them into the curriculum. If they turn out not to stand that way, they'll be rejected.
Clearly, of course.
Then, stranger, shall we now set these down as being among the required subjects, so our laws aren't left with gaps? Let them be set down, though, as pledges that can be redeemed out of the rest of the Constitution, in case they fail to satisfy either us who laid them down, or you who adopted them.
A fair way to put it.
Next, look at the teaching of astronomy for the young, and see whether what's said pleases us or not.
Just say it.
Well, there's a great marvel about these matters, one that's in no way, in no respect, tolerable.
What sort of thing?
We say that no one should investigate or busy himself searching out the causes concerning the greatest God and the whole cosmos, since that wouldn't even be reverent. Yet it seems the exact opposite of this would be the right course.
What do you mean?
What I'm saying sounds paradoxical, and one wouldn't think it fitting for old men to say, but the fact is, once someone believes some subject is fine and true, beneficial to the city, and altogether pleasing to God, there's no way he can then keep from speaking of it.
That's reasonable, but what such subject shall we find concerning the stars?
Good friends, we, practically all of us Greeks, are telling lies about the great gods, the sun and the moon together.
What lie do you mean?
We say that they never travel the same path, and along with them certain other stars, and we call them wanderers.
By Zeus, stranger, that's true. In my own life I've often watched Phosphorus and Hesperus, the morning and evening stars, with certain others besides, never holding to one course, but wandering every which way, while the sun and moon, I think, do the things we all recognize consistently.
This, then, Megillus and Cleinias, is what I say our citizens and our young people need to learn about the gods of the heavens, up to this point regarding all of them, up to the point of not speaking irreverently about them, but always speaking well of them, both when sacrificing and when praying devoutly.
That's right, at least if what you say can in fact be learned, and And further, if what we now say about them isn't correct, but once we've learned we'll say it correctly, then I too agree that a subject of this scope and character should be learned. So, given that this is how things stand, try to explain it thoroughly, and we'll follow along as we learn from you.
What I'm describing isn't easy to learn, but it isn't entirely difficult either, nor does it take an enormously long time. Here's proof. I myself, though I heard of these things neither in my youth nor long ago, could still explain them to the two of you now without taking a great deal of time. Yet if they were truly difficult, I could never have explained them, old as I am, to men as old as you.
True, but what is this subject you call marvelous and fitting for the young to learn, yet one we ourselves don't know? Try to state at least this much about it as clearly as possible.
I'll try, for it isn't correct, best of men, this common belief about the moon, the sun, and the other stars, that they ever wander. The truth is quite the opposite. Each of them travels the same path, not many but always one in a circle, though it appears to move along many paths. And the one among them that's actually fastest is wrongly believed to be slowest, and vice versa. Now if this is how things naturally stand, but we believe otherwise, well, if we thought this way about horses racing at Olympia or long-distance runners, and called the fastest one slowest and the slowest one fastest, and sang hymns of praise crowning the loser as though he'd won, our praises directed at these human runners would be neither correct nor, I think, welcome to the runners themselves. Yet here we are making these very same mistakes concerning the gods. Don't we suppose that what would have been ridiculous and wrong there is, here and now, in this case, not ridiculous at all, yet certainly not pleasing to the gods either, since we're singing false reports about the gods?
Most true, if indeed that's how things are.
So then, if we can show that this is in fact how things stand, all such matters must be learned up to that point. But if it can't be shown, they must be left aside. Shall we agree to leave it on that footing?
By all means.
Now then, we should say the legal provisions concerning subjects of education are complete. As for hunting, we must think along the same lines, and likewise for everything of that sort. For it seems the task facing a lawgiver is greater than simply laying down laws and being done with it. There's something else, in addition to the laws, occupying a middle ground between admonition and law, something that has repeatedly come up in our discussions, as for instance regarding the rearing of very young children. For we say these matters shouldn't be left unspoken, and yet in speaking of them, we'd be quite foolish to think we were laying down laws. Once the laws and the whole Constitution have been written down along these lines, the praise given to the citizen who excels in virtue isn't complete, when one merely says that this man, who has served the laws best and obeyed them most, is the good man. It would be put more completely this way, that whoever obeys the lawgiver's writings, both when he legislates and when he praises or blames and lives out his life accordingly, is unmixed in his virtue. This is the truest account for praising a citizen, and it means the lawgiver really must not only write the laws, but alongside the laws write in, woven together with them, whatever he judges to be honorable and what not, and the citizen at his best must hold to these no less firmly than to the things bound by penalties under the laws. Now if we bring in what's before us at the moment as a kind of witness, we can show more clearly what we mean. Hunting is an enormously varied business, nearly all wrapped up now under a single name. There's a great deal of it in the water, a great deal among winged creatures, and a vast amount concerning creatures of the land, not only wild beasts, but one should also reckon the hunting of human beings as worth considering, both the hunting done in war, and a great deal done in the name of friendship, one kind bringing praise and the other blame. And there is thieving, and the raiding of pirates, and the hunting of armed camps by other armed camps. It is not possible for a lawgiver laying down laws about hunting to leave all this unaddressed, nor is it possible for him to impose on every case ordinances backed by threats and penalties. What then is to be done about such things? The lawgiver must praise and blame hunting as it bears on the labors and pursuits of the young, and the young intern, on hearing this, must obey, and let neither pleasure nor toil bar him from it. And where particular practices have been threatened with penalty and legislated against, he should hold in greater honor those spoken of with praise, and carry out what is enjoined upon him. Once these things have been said in advance, next would come a measured praise and blame of hunting, praise for whatever kind makes the souls of the young better, blame for whatever kind does the opposite. Let us then say what comes next, addressing the young as if in a prayer. Friends, may no desire or longing for hunting at sea ever take hold of you, nor for angling, nor for hunting water creatures at all, whether waking or sleeping, toiling away at that idle hunting with wicker traps. And may no craving for hunting men at sea come over you either, for piracy, which would turn you into brutal and lawless hunters. And as for thieving in country and city, may it never so much as cross your mind to touch it. And may no cunning passion for hunting birds, hardly a fitting one for a free man, ever come over any of the young. What remains, then, for our athletes is only the hunting and pursuit of land creatures. And of these, the hunting of sleeping creatures, done in shifts and called night hunting, is the work of lazy men and does not deserve praise, nor is there anything admirable in overcoming, by nets and traps, rather than by the victory of a hard-working spirit, the wild strength of beasts. What alone remains, then, for everyone, and is best, is the hunting of four-footed creatures with horses and dogs and one's own body, in which the hunters themselves, by running and blows and throws, master all these creatures with their own hands, all those, that is, who care for a hunting worthy of divine courage. Concerning all these kinds, then, the account already given stands as the praise and the blame, and here is the law: let no one hinder these truly sacred hunters wherever and however they wish to hunt. But the night hunter who trusts to nets and woven snares must never anywhere be allowed to hunt at all. As for the fowler, let no one hinder him in untilled land and on the mountains, but whoever comes upon him must keep him off cultivated land and sacred wild land. And as for the hunter of water creatures, he may hunt everywhere except in harbors and sacred rivers and marshes and lakes, provided only that he does not use anything that muddies the water. So now, finally, we may say that everything concerning the laws of education has been dealt with.
You may well say so.